So I'd like to introduce myself. My name is John Jackham. I'm chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and I'm pleased to welcome you here today. As you all know, we're here for a very specific purpose, and that is to honor our four very distinguished gentlemen scholars. I've been asked many times today why it is that we just don't have a nice reception at 5 o'clock and drink and be merry. I think, first of all, that's a difficult question to answer, but I'll try. First of all, we're here today because we have in our midst four individuals whose careers have contributed quite substantially to McGill University. In particular, I think it's good to have a perspective on our department. Our Department of Atmospheric Sciences and previously the Department of Meteorology has been in existence since 1960, and we have conferred over 500 graduate degrees, including about 150 PhDs and 350 Masters of Science degrees. It is the case that the four people that we're honoring today have been responsible for supervising 127 of these degrees, over 25%, including 43 PhDs and 84 master's students. Collectively, they've accounted for 121 years of service to McGill University. And this is actually just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the extent to which they have contributed significantly to teaching, research, and service to the university. I am pleased to inform you today that all four of our honorees are here today in good health and in no way ready to retire from research and their service to the community.
I'd like to please have all of the four stand up.
I feel very honored to have you in our presence, and I'd like to make sure that your wives are properly introduced as well. I think it's appropriate to do that. Monique, would you please stand up? Dominique? Mary? And Marilyn. So, I have actually, these individuals have produced so many graduate degrees and so forth, and I've done my best to invite as many of your former students here as possible today to give you your proper recognition. So, that's why our audience is rather substantial today and will increase as the day wears on. McGill, as the largest department in Canada, has contributed substantially to our leadership globally in academia, government, and in private industry. Today, and the program has been somewhat confidential and a surprise to our honorees, today I've asked distinguished former students and colleagues of our honorees to give presentations to describe for ourselves today the lives, the professional lives, and the personal lives, not entirely personal, of our individuals today. So, as you'll notice in the program, we have an allotment of approximately 30 minutes for those presentations with about 10 minutes of tributes from the audience. And so we're treating every one of our honorees equally during this particular time. And I'd just like to close in my introductory remarks by saying this is in no way a goodbye to our people. In a way, this is our way of understanding our legacy of bringing our entire world community that McGill has contributed so substantively to our understanding of weather and climate change, to the science of weather and climate change. Our four honorees today have laid the foundations for even greater contributions to the future, and I'd like to thank you for that. We deeply appreciate your service. So we're honored to have in our midst today our Dean of Science, Martin Grant, who happens to be from the Department of Physics, which happens to be our predecessor department over 50 years ago, and we have a lot of logical links to that department. And so we appreciate your being here, Martin, and I invite you now to give us a few remarks. Thank you.
Thanks, John. I had not understood before I became dean the fascination of having a dean at an event give remarks, as I didn't find it so fascinating when I was a professor. But I'll do my bit today. Thanks very much for asking me to speak, and I do consider it an honor to speak here today. Let me give a little bit of a different take than I usually give at talks like this. I speak at many events these days. And typically, I talk about the renewal of McGill. I talk about the great new professors we've hired over the last 5 or 10 years. I talk about the ranking of our university as one of the top universities in the world, in a situation where most of our professors are just starting their careers. I talk about our great students, who are the best in the world, and how we provide opportunities for them to succeed. And I talk about those who have achieved. Last year, there were 2 of our graduates received Nobel Prizes, and the pride we take in acknowledging their success. Sometimes I talk about the past, our history as a university, 50 years ago when your department was started, a century ago, the innovative work of Frederick Soddy, of Ernest Rutherford, of Stuart Marshall, of William Dawson. And I talk about the golden age of science from 50 years ago or a century ago. And then I talk about a new golden age of science about to begin at McGill, the opportunities we have, the point in our history that we've reached, and the time at which we are right now that within the next handful of years, we can truly take our place as one of the world's grand écoles. I speak to students, I speak to our staff, to our alumni, to philanthropists. I speak to many philanthropists. It's an exciting message, and every bit of it is true. But I never talk about how we got here, how we became poised to leap ahead. I never talk about, and now I'm being taped, but I never talk about McGill in the mid-1990s, 15 or 20 years ago. Those were hard times here in the 1990s. We cut 5% of our budget every year for 6 years, or was it 6% of our budget every year for 5 years? Those of us who were here then don't even remember. What we remember is submitting proposals to budget planning groups, to prioritizing this and that, to looking to what could be cut at that time. Difficult times here. It would have been an easy time for a university to have lost its way. Other universities and other places did lose their way. It would have been an easy time for a department to lose its way. And we did not, and Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences did not. Even though it's one of the smaller departments in our university with a proud history. Our success now at McGill, where we are poised to be right now at McGill, is a direct result of our leadership 15 or 20 years ago. The iron men and women of our university ensured that when we started to hire 100 people a year, every year, in the first decade of this century, we had the departmental cultures, the communities, and the values to integrate them into our mission. Values of respect for excellence and respect for colleagues. Values well embodied in this department. As well, values well embodied by the men we are honoring today, all of them iron men of the university. You will hear much more about them throughout the afternoon, so I will be brief, or even briefer. Ishtar Zawadzki took over the J.S. Marshall Radar Observatory in difficult times, which I know because physics is running it before, and made the success it is now. Lawrence Mizak, the first elected president of the Royal Society of Canada, a lifelong contribution to excellence and the recognition of excellence. Henry Layton, just an anecdote about Henry rather than this. So Henry was working with me because he was associate dean that Alan had hired. And this is a typical thing with Henry, is that he would come to my office, slouch into a chair, and frown, and say, "Martin, I really don't think we should be doing that." And after the first time or two, I realized, when Henry speaks, shut up and listen. And Jacques Durome, the Iron Man of Iron Men in this university. His achievements and his commitment to the department and the university are well known everywhere in this university. The great shape in which the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences is in now, the great young professors, some of them here today, the great students, the great ranking of the department, the great promise for the future, all of this is due in no small part to the leadership of these four men. As I said, it's not something I usually talk about, but here this afternoon we honor some of those who are the reason for McGill's present success and future promise. These men make me proud and honored, and indeed feel privileged to be a member of the Faculty of Science. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. Really appreciate those kind words. So you'll notice that in your program today, we have our first speaker discussing the career of Professor Jacques Durome, and this is Dr. Gilbert Brunet. Dr. Brunet received his PhD from McGill University in 1989. He is currently head of the Meteorological Research Division at Environment Canada at Dorval. He is the chair of the Joint Scientific Committee of the World Weather Research Program of the World Meteorological Organization. He is established as an expert in dynamical meteorology since his postdoctoral work in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge in the UK, along with the Laboratoire de Meteorologie Dynamique in Paris. And his work covers analytical and empirical studies of wave processes from regional to planetary scales, along with numerical weather prediction from actually just minutes to those of seasons. So we're pleased to welcome here today Dr. Gilbert Brunet.
Thank you, John. I'd like to thank first the Department of Atmospheric and Ocean Science to invite me to give a tribute to Jacques. It's a real pleasure to do that. Okay, I try to make this not too high level in terms of science. So I see the family there, and I think you'll enjoy that. So what I'll do is to establish the stage, the historical stage, because any scientist starts with something, a baggage, what people done before, the ancestors, the former colleague. So I'll do that in a few slides, and then you'll see, but I'll focus, of course, on what has contributed to the scientist that we know, Jacques. And after that, I'll go through his career, and hopefully, I think you'll have a good insight of what he contributed. Okay, well, it started all there, okay? Okay. You know those equations, Jacques, I'm sure. Okay. Numerical weather prediction modeling are based on those physical law fluids. And that's the last time I'm showing some mathematics for the sake of the others. And but that's something that Jacques have done a lot, is to work on this equation, understanding the different processes which go along with them. And this equation are the base also for predictability in dynamical process studies, and that's what Jacques done a lot in his career. Now, those equations are very complex, and you need to deal with them using computer. That's probably another ingredient of Jacques' career, is to be able to work with computers and to look in these equations, to solve them, to use them to predict, and also to understand the different dynamical process. But no computer in the 20s. The first one to think about that was Richardson, and he has put together a monograph on the topic, and this is an image coming out from that monograph where he thought of a sphere with the geography all over the wall with rows of people making calculation to be able, maybe Jacques one day, to do those diagnostics. But of course, Richardson realized that to do a proper prediction with such approach, it would take 60,000 people. So he quit and went to something else. But this was the ancestor of computers before even we talk about them, especially massively parallel computers. So that's a second ingredient to the career of Jacques. Jacques' childhood, already it was well known, urban legends say that he was playing with red balls, and that's Jacques when he was young. And he used to hit them a little bit, doing some disturbance to see how they will propagate around the sphere. So we all know that these are Rossby waves, but he was too young to publish the results, so Rossby got the credit. But that's another side of Jacques, is that he is a theoretician, a dynamician, and he looked in those processes very carefully. So we got, at the end, our first computers. Charnais with von Neumann, which was the pioneer of modern computer, done the first iteration of this equation, and from that something started. Especially around here in the 60s at McGill, there was a lot of activity in using computer to solve those equations. Just to put the context, at the time, well-known Henri Robert was the first one to integrate a spectral model, a global model, which is very important, because before that, all the models were limited area, just focusing on a region. But if you want to do a proper prediction or to do climate simulation, you need to have a global model. And this was the first time they were able to do such integration. That was the time where Jacques was around, studying. At the same time, in the 60s, and another important component of Jacques' career, is there was an unprecedented space and surface-based observation system that was put in operation. So observation is very important. Jacques have done a lot of work using observation to make sure what he's saying is truthful, as a good scientist should do. So that's the context. Now we have Jacques. Okay. Picture is a true one. Monix chosen him when he was like that, I'm sure. And he done his BSc in meteorology at McGill in 63, went to McGill for the MSc in 64, and went to the U.S. in 68 before 68, but got his PhD in University of Michigan. And he done a postdoctoral research fellow in MIT, 68 to 69. And that's interesting. I think this will influence also very well Jacques' career, is that he worked at the Met Service for 3 years at the end of the 60s. Jacques' thesis was done with Wim Nielsen. As you know, he was the founder of the European Center, the SMWF. And already you could see the interest of Jacques that will never stop in the years to follow, the decades to follow, is to look at these equations that I've shown you and to make simplified version of them so we can understand the process properly. Quasi-geostrophic formulation is an example. Looking at different contributions to the different terms so that he could get some insight in what is making the atmosphere to vary, to be variable in time. And also try to understand how the nonlinear interaction that we find in those equations can sustain such flow that we see. So that certainly was a very big challenge, not the only one to do that, but he went along in that direction. And, of course, as I said, using always observed values to be able to get real insight in the real atmosphere. I've just put here, there's a saying in English where you say, tell me that tell me what you read, and I will tell you what you are. Well, there's something else you can see for scientists sometimes, is that tell me what you wrote first, and I will tell you who you are. And if you look at the six first papers, you can see that there is keyword there, that it will come back in his career as something that he's looked at. I'll try to make a point here along those slides, is that Jacques has had a project in mind, as a program, and he followed that clearly all along his career. He didn't go do a paper on this topic, try to find another excuse to do something else. He really stick to the problem that he said he wanted to deal with. And that's something which I commend. And so he was looking at different way that the atmosphere would be sustained, each source. Something immediately, four papers, paper where you done alone in 72, propagation of local errors, already understanding those equations are not perfect. And we need to understand how the error propagate when we try to do the prediction. So already at the beginning, he was looking at this problem. And you have two other papers where you start looking at numerical with a prediction. And with Hubert Allard, Hubert is here today. And also a paper with Christiane Baudouin, which still works at RPN. I'm not sure she's here today. But so he has also trained at the same time in that science a lot of people who are still working around in numerical with a prediction. Then, well, after the stay at RPN, he went as a professor at the Department of Mythology since 1972. You see his colleague here. I think I know all of them, Hitchfeld, Rogers, Lyon Orr, and Phil Merrillis. And the last one, I'm not sure. Okay. Oh, right. I never met him, so it's fine. Well, okay. That was a good time, fantastic time. Why? Well, Charney set up this first integration of a model, and in the 60s, he wrote this strategic plan, a program of research for our community, which was called the Global Atmospheric Research Program. At the start, Jacques was on board. He was a member of the GARP UCAR Council, and eventually the Canadian version from 74-18. This was a very interesting endeavor. This program was to improve weather prediction and the modeling of the atmosphere. And Charney used to say that we should deal with that problem first. Well, I don't like to talk about other people, especially those people who are very well known. But we need to deal with those problems first. Then we should try to tackle the climate problem. Of course, there was some urgency to do that before we understood all this problem perfectly. But that would probably influence a lot what Jacques done after that in his career. He visited the European Center in 79-80, and after that he went to the World Climate Research Program to work. So he always been between the two, weather and climate. He was always working in that region of time scale, which is quite unique, I would say, at that time. So that's it. That's a picture which is more close to what we know now, Jacques. An accomplished scientist with nationally and internationally recognized expertise in predictability and dynamical process at the weather-climate interface. If I'd like to summarize what Jacques was doing, I think that was it. You can correct me later if you want, Jacques, but that's what I perceive from you. So major contribution in meteorology. Well, he has published more than 65 publications, and I would say 20 of them are related to the weather climate prediction problem, the numerical weather prediction problem, and 40 of them and more are looking at the underlying dynamical process of weather and climate. He has worked with many people. I could not name all of them, but I name here the people who have done at least two papers with him on the topic, and Brunet, Dugas, Fife, Nicol, Heilin, McLandres, Mitchell, Lawrence, Shang, and Vindenson, and Ertanzara. All on the low frequency variability. An example, the Maiden-Julian Oscillation. I'll talk a little bit about it later. Dynamical process, mean wave, wave-wave interaction and forcing, weather regime, the North Atlantic Oscillation, the Arctic Oscillation. I'm sure, Monique, you've heard Arctic Oscillation one time in your life. The PNA. And blockings, which affect a lot the Atlantic one, at least, affect a lot the weather over Europe. And he's nationally and internationally recognized for that. I can make this point with a lot of confidence. He started to do work also in prediction. I think the paper who started that was with myself and others, which was established a solid effort in seasonal prediction. And this has culminated in a well-established program in Canada for seasonal prediction. And that system is now in operation at Environment Canada, and it's, I would say, one of the good models that we have around the world to do that sort of prediction. Something else which I think is a major contribution is the work of Jacques with himself on ensemble prediction and with Peter Utukamer, which were critical to the development of an ensemble prediction system at Environment Canada that is recognized internationally and the most innovative of the existing operational system at this moment. Peter Utukamer, ensemble Kalman filter that is developed initially with the work of Jacques, is the top-notch ensemble prediction system in the world. Everyone is copying us on this now. Some work, I don't want to go into detail, with John Fife, just to give a flavor to the people who are scientists here to see such sort of thing he has done along the years. In the late 80s, Durham and Fife published a series of fundamental theoretical papers on the stability of the topographic component of the general circulation, looking at the fasting growing mode. So this was always been an interest for Jacques to understand really well what's the cause of what we're observing at large scale. The same sort of thing was done with Ayrton Zadra, one of the students that I've co-chaired with him, which was looking at wave process. What he was doing when he was a little baby, right, hitting the ball, where we have those disturbances around the atmosphere globally. And we point out that a certain of these waves, which explain a lot of the variability of weather, are certainly linked with the tropopause in what we call quasi-mode. I think there is an interesting result there that I don't have time today to go through, but that's sort of things that you look at. Predictability of dynamical process. This is lately. Not too far ago, 2009, a paper where we do an observed connection between the North Atlantic Oscillation and the Mediterranean Oscillation in the Journal of Climate. For people who are not familiar with this, I give you an example here of the different phase of the MGO, where we can see with the initial condition how it evolves in time. It's almost the most periodic signal that we have in the tropics, which can have a peak around 50 days. And the fact that it can be so well predicted is a challenge because a lot of the models that we have now, the most accurate model, are not able to do that properly. But simple statistical model can do it. So, and we know now that this is affecting the weather also in mid-latitude like here in North America. So we've looked into this. So Jacques, with his colleague, me and I, we have looked at what we call the weather climate time scale and trying to understand how this could happen. In this case, we try to link the MGO with the North Atlantic Oscillation. The North Atlantic Oscillation is a dipole structure in the jet. Essentially, a jet can move in the Atlantic, the same jet that people or air pilot use to save fuel when they go to Europe. That jet can move and change a lot the weather patterns over Europe and also over the northeast of North America. What essentially we've done here in this work is to show there's a correlation. If you look at the phase of MGO from 1, 2, 3, 4 to 8, and you look at pentad lag with pentad 5 days, so 0 is correlation at the same time, -1, 5 days before, -2, 10 days before, and like that, we found this nice quadruple structure. And we went on. In fact, we've seen this thing in doing simple modeling experiment years before. And then we went to see if this exists in the atmosphere, so we're not just fishing for correlation in a statistical sense. So that was something very important with Jacques, is always using proper statistics based on good explanation, good dynamical causality. And that I have learned a lot with him since I was a PhD student in 85 with him, not with him, but talking with him a lot on this. Topical influence, that's an example of what's happening in the case where there's a correlation. An NGO which is initiated in the Pacific, which is quite strong, and is phase 3, if you look at 5 days, 10 days, 15 days later, you see that on the right-hand side over the Atlantic, you excite the NGO. So how this happened, when then we go in those papers, but I don't want to give the detail, but again, this effort to explain dynamically what's going on, and we could show with wave activity flux how a Rossby wave packet could propagate from the tropics and bring energy to the mid-latitude in the Atlantic, which make a very convincing case that we were on good track here. Now, end result of this for this paper was that we've shown that the North Atlantic Oscillation amplitude increased a lot after the MGO convection anomaly that reached the Western Pacific. What happened is that this NAO is associated with a Rossby wave train. And this, you've never seen that, Jacques, but I want to just show it to you to make the case that things are continuing. And this is the Environment Canada forecasting system looking at the NAO forecast scale in terms of pentan to 30 days and the correlation scale. And we just stratify this result in terms of weak MGO or strong MGO. And you can certainly see that when MGO is strong, you have an increase in scale in the score here. And the reverse, as we've shown, also the North Atlantic Oscillation can influence also MGO. This was a very new result, surprising that was part of the paper. We see it also when we try to predict. If we have a strong NAO, we get a better prediction of MGO 30 days in advance with that system. And this is a significant result. So how 30 years, 40 years ago, we could not, never been able to do that sort of work. We have pushed the limit now to are able to look at the weather-climate interface. Internationally now, people are looking more and more to work with weather research group and with climate research group to be able to achieve such result and to make sure that climate and weather models benefit from all that research. The last one is the work by Jacques on modeling errors in ensemble prediction. As already stated, in 72, Jacques already wrote a paper on propagation of local errors in primitive equation model. He was already thinking about that and kept his pace, eventually wrote a few papers on this until, and that's Peter Tukamer, citation that he just gave me a few days ago. Jacques and I arrived in the fall of 1992 at RPN. My task as a postdoc was to design a medium-range ensemble prediction system for RPN. Following Jacques' recommendation, we started simple with a two-member ensemble or bread mode. We moved on to singular vector, which were somewhat difficult. We eventually settled on a nice and simple Monte Carlo method. When Jacques returned to McGill after 1 year of sabbatic at RPN, you have to do that. You could go to Paris, you could go everywhere. He went to Dorval, okay? Because he really believed in what he's doing. Or maybe Monique won him not too far, but who knows? Anyhow, we have benefit from it. Well, at the end, when Jacques returned to McGill, we had the blueprint of what would become the Canadian medium range ensemble prediction system, which is well recognized now. I won't go into detail with that, but this went on after that. With three papers, which established very solidly this system that we have developed. Now, a few important recognition I should add on this. Well, as it was already mentioned, he has held position of chair of department 3 times, doing that very well. Something which is prestigious in my eyes, chair or co-chair of the standard seminar in dynamic meteorology, something that any dynamician, any person working in meteorology internationally will is aware of, find those standard seminar very useful, of high quality, and he was involved many times in it. He was president of CMOS in 1994-95. He is principal investigator, the Canadian Climate Variability Research Network, since 2001. I won't name all of them, but numerous national and international committees. 95, Oscar Villeneuve Prize, the Société de Météorologie de Québec. He received the Patterson Medal for Distinguished Service to Meteorology in Canada. In 2000, he has obtained the Fellow the fellow of the Canadian Meteorological Oceanic Society, for making major contribution to atmospheric dynamic research, as I think I tried to make the case. He was also chair of the last joint assembly with IMF, IPO, and IAICS in 2009 in Montreal. And finally, in 2006, he was made fellow of the Royal Society of Canada for achievement over a career, which is great. I'm not sure what we can give more after that. He could be knighted. I don't want to call you sir. But maybe Lady Monique, yes. So, what else? Lots of challenge. So at the dawn of this new century, significant research and development challenge remain to be met at the interface of weather and climate prediction. But Jacques has something else on his mind. Enjoy weather and climate. So I got this picture from Monique, I'm sure. And got some email from a few people. I won't go through all of them, but John Five, Hirsch Mitchell, Lingred C, Rabat Eder, and other people. And all your former students, I'm sure some are here now, quite happy to thank you for all what you've done with them. And I think the last one is from me. I think one serious, which is less personal, I think the dedication of his work with government scientists as his permit his scientific contribution to have an incredible impact on the Canadian society. The socioeconomic of Jacques Carrie is outstanding. If you think the help he gave us in developing an ensemble prediction system, which is, as I said, one of the best in the world, and the work you've done with seasonal prediction, if you look at the impact of seasonal prediction for hydroelectricity companies, for health issues, for I could just name them for minutes without stopping, he has really well connected that he makes sure that science would be beneficial to the society, and I think he's done very well there. Now, there's different scientists that I've met since my career started in the beginning of the 80s. Some are fast. They'll make a paper with you in a few months, go to another problem, go like that. What I admired from Jacques was to have a clear idea what he wants, and if it took one decade, two decades to get there, he would continue and push this forward. And it always reminds me, I like to hike in mountains, and it's a trail that go. Sometimes you see things, sometimes very high, so, God, I won't get there. But with him, at the side, we're just talking, taking things cool, and doing it very rigorously. At the end, we get at that top, and we're very happy to be there. So I will stop on this. And the nice thing about here, this sort of thing, I don't need to answer questions.
So now we'll take questions.
No problem.
At this point in the program, we've allocated some time for tributes from the audience who would like to do that. I'd like to start out, actually. It turns out when I first came to McGill, the person who recruited me was, in fact, Roddy Rogers, who was chair of the department when I first was recruited. And then when I showed up at McGill, turns out that my boss was Jacques. I had no idea Roddy had stepped down as chair. But I can tell you that I can think of no finer boss than Jacques, someone who treats people with dignity and respect, regardless of how bad the publication record was at the time. He, when I first showed up at McGill, I think he had a look at my CV and basically called me into his office, and we had a talk about that. And he did a really great job in allowing me to embellish my CV to the extent that it looked decent. And I really appreciate all of your guidance and your mentoring over the years, Jacques. You are a tremendous colleague, and I really I will miss you. I hope you can stay around for a long time. Anybody else?
I just wanted to say a few words. I was thinking about that thing. very long. I told you, this man did a, he had a pretty outstanding career in research about all of that. And I tried more than once to divert him from that career. As you mentioned, you could not, there's no finer plus than finer nerd. So I tried to attract him. I was Environment Canada to come with us and work with us as a senior level manager in Environment Canada. Of course, in the area of the scientific research. And I'm not sure if Monique had something to do with that. Certainly, Jacques never finally decided to come, back, I should say, to the But I'm sure, and there were many of us who would have liked Jacques to come back. And as a senior level manager in Monique. So that, we'll find it.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, and I believe on your program you have Zhenqin Li. Zhenqin is currently a professor at the University of Maryland in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Science and Earth System Science Interdisciplinary Center. He received his PhD in 1991 in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at McGill. He is currently a full professor, having been having earned that honor in 2001. He's received 6 major awards. He's supervised 15 PhDs, 15 PhD students. He's produced 160 papers with 2,300 citations. And for those of you in the know, he has an H index of 26. He's had 25 invited talks at international conferences and workshops. His expertise, as you might expect, is of in remote sensing, climate, radiation, cloud, aerosol, forest fire, land, and environmental matters. So we're pleased to welcome in our presence today Dr. Zhenqin Li, who's going to talk about Henry's career.
Good morning, everybody. I'm very, very pleased to see who is there. I'm very pleased and honored to be here. Although this is a occasion for tribute to my dear Professor Henry Layton, but I also like to take this opportunity to thank all the professors who taught me at McGill, made me standing here, and really this is a great opportunity. I think if you see these photos, you know Henry seems to never aged. He always looked like that. Since the day I met him, I thought he looked like that, and even today he still looks like that. Of course, myself changed a lot. And of course, if you treat early enough, he does not look really the same. As I put here, once upon a time, not that long time ago, the little Henry seems full of hope in his eyes for his future. I'm really amazed to see his eyes. You know, they just look like, look forward to the future, to the brighter, career. I think the right photo shows his confidence, which made me confident even though in the difficult times at the beginning of my PhD research, I always feel being encouraged by him all the time. And these are a few photos I just received last night, which I even have a hard time to figure out who's who here. Can anybody guess who is Henry on this photo? I guess this one, this guy, right? Henry, is that you? Yeah, this looks very young, handsome. And I guess this is surrounded by your family members when you receive your bachelor degree. And the next two photos shows a great-grandpa with his grandchildren. And this is really shows Henry another side of his life. He's always a very caring father and grandfather. And of course, many of us lucky to be his colleague and student. He has a good time with many of us. These two, they are going to retire, I hope. And this Lawrence Maddock and Prophet Henry Layton will have unlimited time to do barbecue day by day, 7 days a week, I hope. And this is me and my academic brother. And Henry, when he graduated, and I had opportunity to see his lovely home. And this look like many of his former students. And I'll say, you know, Henry has so many students that I know only a very few of them, partially because Henry has so large research interest, which I do not really came across after. Here is a little brief history about Henry. He was born in London, like me, as an immigrant to Canada, look like. He had three children, I met two of them at his home, and also as look very handsome. And he got his PhD, bachelor degree from McGill, MSc from McGill, and only PhD is outside of McGill, University of Alberta, 1968. And this is a brief history of his work. You know, after graduating with a PhD degree, he was a research associate, went to Netherlands University of Utrecht, and then he spent a year or two as a visiting assistant professor at University of Kentucky. After that, I'm very surprised. He spent, almost 40 years at McGill. So he got his 2 degrees from McGill. He's probably the longest person associated with McGill among this audience, I just assume. You know, he climbed an academic ladder from assistant to a full professor at McGill. And he's served as associate dean and working with a lot of people around the campus. His research field is just amazingly surprisingly wide, so wide that I can really not speak of him's accomplishment in front of many experts, because he, you know, started with nuclear physics. Yeah, look at his CV. He spent 10 years published papers in Journal of Nuclear Physics. And this, even the title, I have a hard time to understand what they are about. It's just very, very physics. You know. probably because the only link with his current work is cloud physics. I don't know if nuclear physics and cloud physics have anything in common. Probably, he had nothing, right? Nuclear physics, you know, nucleation. Cloud physics start with activation, so somewhat like, I guess. That's probably led to your career in cloud physics. That's shortly after his nuclear physics study in the first 10 years. He published his first cloud physics paper in 1974. And I will show you an example of that. Then he moved on to ready transfer. And one of his early papers is comment on other people's work on ready transfer, which is kind of rare, because if you just step into a new territory, you know, you better shut, you know, your mouth, because you may meet the enemy before you publish your first paper. That shows his courage of, you know, making critical comment about other work. But anyway, that's and I read his first ready transfer paper is in 1979 about ready transfer as phase function. So that was the first time I read his paper, and then he spent time with his former student and myself on remote sensing of radiation and cloud, and actually at the same time he did a lot of work with, on power studies. In recent years he spent a lot of time on aerosol research, and actually in the 1980s I remember he has a very widely cited paper on chemistry, 1987 I think, with Tremblay. Later he worked on model diagnosis. You know, given the long list and very rather diverse field of his research, I just don't feel eligible to discuss much of his work. I just chose a few, and also forgive me for not having enough time to digest his research, because I just came back at midnight from China. My original plan was will come back on this weekend when the chairman, Professor John, come to ask me to give this talk. I said I already made up my plan, and I think, you know, my life has been benefited so much from Henry, so I got to show up. So I just cut short my trip, and I had almost you know, a full day meeting every day since I arrived in China, in order to come back 3 days earlier. As a result, I didn't have much time to digest his many artwork. As a result, I just chose a few. Work with his students and colleagues and PDFs. He supervised 8 PhD students, and as I mentioned, these 8 students have been active in many different areas. You know, that's why I do not really know well my academic brothers, sisters, I just met a few here, and I hope at the end of my talk you can talk about your accomplishment with Henry, while I just choose a few samples. I will spend probably more time on my own work with Henry, because that I'm more confident to explain. Okay. This is I don't know, this looks like spaghetti, but it is certainly more complex than spaghetti. This is actually his paper in 1974 about cloud growth, cloud droplet, how cloud droplet grow. You know, for those of you who are not in meteorology, you may not know there is a lot of complex process going on for raindrop to come down the ground. Okay, in order for to see the cloud in the sky, we have to, the cloud need to grow enough. Okay, so after nucleation, cloud will grow by two means. One is diffusion growth, one is accretion growth. But what make raindrop, cloud drop grow big enough to become raindrops? The traditional theory is just by colliance, you know, big drops collect small ones. What Henry's work shows that it's not just collision, but also diffusion. So the both process play an important role in cloud development. And this is a very early pioneer work on cloud phase. I think this is very important. That's the very early days work. This is the very latest work Henry did with his former PhD student, Frank Jen, I think. And they basically try to use satellite data to constrain model. You know, models is basically people's more or less imaginative work, in the sense that they basically use those equations that Dr. Brown showed earlier, and then let the model run and get what the nature look like. But this phenomenon of simulated by model may or may not represent what happened in nature. As a result, we need to do diagnosis. So Henry did a lot of work with his two former students, including myself, and has this is just one regional comparison of a McKinsey plan, and that shows some region, the difference is pretty large. This is in terms of watts per square meter, I guess. And another type of work that Henry did is the changes to the radiation energy caused by aerosol. This is smoke from cleaning fires, how much smoke will change the energy at the top of the atmosphere, and you can see the effect is very dependent on how heavy is the smoke. Okay, I will just do a little more on my own research and career impact by Henry's supervision, because this year, as I said, I can explain more clearly. Instead of confuse you, and I will just try to explain. I just did a survey of my own research and ranked them according to citations. It's quite amazing. The highest citation of my papers happened to be not happened to be. There is a good reason. Our papers with Henry when I was a student, I had five papers. The top one with citations of 110 is with Lee and Henry Layton JGR in 1993. And that is about global energy balance produced from satellite. I will show you a little more showing that. And that was based on the algorithm that we developed together for using satellite data to retrieve surface radiation budget. So number one and number three are basically work with Henry. And this is quite amazing. Number 17, number 19, and number 21 was also with Henry. So I must say, after I left McGill, my originality probably reduced somewhat. Citation, number citation certainly not as good as when I was here. Anyhow, I think I'll show you a few of these details, what they are. This diagram was a lot. That somebody said one picture was 1,000 words. To me, this was 10,000 words, because this diagram has been so widely used. Now, every year, still there's papers using this diagram or this algorithm. Okay, there is a little history behind this diagram. Let me first explain what this diagram is about. So when we do satellite remote sensing, what we see from satellite is really reflection from everything below. Cloud, aerosol, surface, water vapor, etc. all contribute to reflection. What we are up to is the energy reaching the ground. So there is so much things you need to correct. Cloud, in particular aerosol, in between. So you need to correct for all those in order to know how much comes down to surface. Prior to our study, there has been many studies. There are 10 models at least have different method. The problem with previous models is either too simple or too complicated. Too simple, too simple in the sense they are empirical relation. Empirical relation was basically derived from wherever you got the data, you got the formula. The formula may not apply to other region, other conditions, and these are simple, of course. Too complicated means you have to get so much input data, and you have to use a Fourier transform model to calculate. So it's too time consuming to be useful. So when we start our work, we basically try to find something in between. Simple enough, you can use for operation, but meanwhile, accurate enough that you do not sacrifice your accuracy. So as a result, what we did is a so-called parameterized model, which is based on the detailed full-fledged radiation transfer model, and they try to find a fundamental relation that governs the retrieval of a sub-radiation budget. So one day, I present this diagram without the line. I don't know if Henry, you probably still recall that. I present that diagram to Henry. I said, this is the result we got. It seems that the dot is kind of random. And Henry just look at it and then say, oh, let's draw a line. So we draw this line for the same angle. This is a line for the same angle. This is a reflected flux modeled by Rick Chan's model, and this is surface absorbed flux. This is what we are looking for. This is what satellites provide. Okay? So this is something we know. This is something we want. So if you know the sun angle, okay, this is, for example, if it's 53 degrees, and if you know the reflection is 400, you will know immediately surface flux is about 210. What the beauty of this diagram is that we do not need to know what's the cloud optical depth. This point is formed by changing cloud optical depth. This is a very fundamental discovery because all the previous work spent at least half of their energy computing power to calculate the cloud optical depth. What these diagrams told us is you do not need to know cloud optical depth because cloud influence is buried in the reflection as measured by a satellite. So basically you shortcut of this complex process. And just starting from here, we tested many, many other influence factors. Also, surface albedo, we always got a very nice straight line. So as a result, when we simulate all kind of situation, just using five formulas, okay, five equations, we can reproduce surface energy and compare with the detailed model simulation, we found 90% of the retrieval is accurate to within 10 watts per square meter. This is the highest accuracy even compared with the detailed retrans model. So this is the point when our retrieval has been recognized. Professor Bob Sess from University of New York, and he tested our algorithm before our algorithm. NASA used his algorithm. When he tested ours, no matter what condition it has, always better than his and others. So he just called NASA to stop using his and using ours. That's pretty a remarkable achievement. I think I was quite encouraged when I was a student at that time. So just using that algorithm, we generate a global climatology of radiation balance. This is 4 months of global energy, how much solar radiation come and absorb by ground. This look like just ordinary images, but if you look at the next one, it's really not so ordinary. I don't know if you recall the numbers, but I'm sure all the meteorologists know this diagram because in many classical meteorology, you see this energy breakdown. And there are many numbers. I just want to draw your attention to these numbers, okay? The total amount of energy coming down, we consider as 100%, 30% will be reflected into space. 70% will either be absorbed by ground or by atmosphere. For a long, long time, since before 1990s, this number is probably influenced by the class textbook before then, was the surface received is about 51%. If you look at Peter Hobbs' paper, Peter Hobbs and Wallace's introduction to meteorology at Earth Science, this was 51%. The number we got is 46%. So at that time, if I just use a simple diagram, there were three numbers floating at that time. Ours is 46%. And the GCMs, the vast majority is 50% or 51. And another school of proposing very low value, 42%. How significant is this? 50% versus 46% is 25 watts per square meter. 25 watts per square meter is five times doubling CO2 effect, which means if our understanding of climate has so much uncertainty in the energy coming down to the surface, your climate prediction is very much in doubt because the energy is just too much, not in balance. Okay? So for a long time since 1990s, about debate about how much energy. So this diagram appeared in the cover of a bulletin of American Meteorological Society by Bruce Wilicki from NASA, basically adopt our value, which is very different from previous numbers. And this is shows that time, the long debate about the energy distribution. and almost 10 years debate about energy balance. In 2009, before then, there's a number just floating very widely. But after this number just little by little closer to our value. This is the 2009 by paper by Chambers from ENCA on BAMS. His quotation of this is 161. Remember, our number is 157. So it's about just 4 watts difference. Prior to our values, it was 181 watts. So there is a huge number difference. Okay, and in between there is interesting things. So this is my paper 1997 that was also traced to the work with Henry about climatology. We did a survey of global energy by all GCM. At that time, you can see all the GCM. This is all the GCM values. And this is there is a huge number difference. Okay, our value of surface energy balance, is the lowest one. Okay, and this is the start of the debate about energy balance and where those missing energy, if they are. And we show that one is cloudy sky. This is clear sky. So our finding is that the energy difference among different sources, in particular between models and observation, will happen to both cloudy conditions and clear skies. As a result, we think it is a clear sky problem more due to water vapor absorption and aerosol absorption. But a group of scientists in U.S. proposed this is because of cloud absorption anomaly. This is a big debate for half century because 1957 there was the first report of a discrepancy between energy computed by models and observation. That's a huge anomaly reported by three papers in science, basically about proposed a huge cloud problem. In the same year, we published a paper more or less still traced to our work, my PhD work, and we published a paper in Nature demonstrate this problem really not a cloud problem but clear sky aerosol absorption problem. And this debate lasted until 2004 when we have the last round of debate in science. And now settled, I'm pleased to tell you our number of radiation balance is the most reliable number from satellite. And cloud absorption normally has been resolved, and it's not cloud problem, but it's also a water vapor problem, as we argued from beginning. So I would say, you can see, even though I have done a lot of work after graduation, but many of this work traced to my PhD studies. So I would say Henry really has changed my life, and many others, in particular his former student, postdocs. And today he is going to retire. I hope his legacy will not retire with him. And I'm sure many will be inspired by his great contribution to science. And in particular, we feel lucky to work with him because he is always so kind, and we do not feel any pressure to work with him. Thank you very much, Henry.
We have time for a question or two from Dr. Lee.
Not really a question for me, but your tribute to Henry. No,
okay. I have worked with Henry for about 7 years. And just now I have to figure out something that I can say. And first, I would say, as Dr. Lee mentioned, Henry is a very encourage you to do some idea. give some idea. You know, that it looks that it's very, very clear. But he always impacts you, see. And another few things that I record. Then we had a group meeting, and every time I brought cookie from people. It's better than everything, it's different. It's a very nice cookie. I want to thank you and smile on the and the thing I will remember is when I was a student, when I first came here, and my English is not that good, when I oral exam, I remember Terry tried to help me, and he asked me to come to his office and maybe twice a week help me to practice my English. I think that's a former top professor, and I realized that time is very valuable, but he was very trying to practice English with me. So I want to thank Terry.
Of the professionary interpreter Aria and Professor Yao, we give the new explanation for the human flash formation. So in this special occasion, I just can say thank you so much for your supervision. Thank you so much.
I learned an incredible amount about ethics and compassion general approach to training me was for me to go stomping into his office at any hour because he put up with me going at any time, rattling on about my dilemma du jour, and he just sit and watch it. Wait till I got myself through and figured out the answer and go, yep. I say yes, thank you.
Henry and Mary, this flower is for you.
So I have something to say. In 1992, Jacques stepped down as chair, and Henry took over, I believe, from 92 to 95. And so Henry was my second boss. And I want everybody to realize that this was a period of time, like Martin Grant mentioned, the beginning of some difficult times for McGill. After Henry stepped down again, Jacques took over, and these guys pretty much kept our department together, held it with great assertion, and made sure that we made the right decision so that the department is what it is today. So I really appreciate that service as chair. And in particular, when Henry was chair, I was actually contemplating leaving McGill and going to some other university in North America, and he convinced me to stay, and I'll never regret that. You've been a great, great mentor, Henry. I appreciate it. So at this point, we're actually pretty close to schedule. If I understand things correctly, we have a health break until about 3:30. Thank you.